Hello and welcome to Ordinary, a podcast that aims to help Christians live for Christ in everyday life. My name is Josh Bannister, and each week I'm joined by Graham Nichols and Mark Bentham, both pastors of Christ Church, Haywards Heath. It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas, and for two of us at least here on the Ordinary crew, that's a very exciting proposition. I wonder if you can guess which two. It'll become clear pretty soon. This week we're talking about the Christmas story. This is sort of a less intense Ordinary Apologetics episode, which should help you to ground the story of Christmas in real history and be confident to share it. But it's not completely given over to apologetics, because we also spend time talking about the manner in which we as Christians want to celebrate this festival. So enjoy the podcast, and I'll catch you on the other side.
My name's Graham Nichols.
I'm Mark Bentham.
And I'm Josh Bannister, and you're listening to Ordinary.
And Christmas is coming soon. That's if true. You're listening a little bit on catch-up and you've already gone past Christmas, sorry about that, but we are getting ready for Christmas, and we are going to talk a little bit about Christmas today.
That's right, we're talking about, well, we're going to talk a bit about apologetics today, to do with the Christmas story, but also Christmas more generally. What's your favourite thing about Christmas, Graham? Are you a Christmas kind of guy? I have to say, my assumption would be that you're not that into it.
Oh, no, I am into it.
Are you?
I'm into the idea, but in the reality, I just like to do ordinary things. Open a few presents, eat food, go out for a walk.
Yeah.
So there's nothing particularly kind of novel. But in concept...
Do you feel the magic of Christmas?
Well, yeah, I think it's a childhood thing that's quite difficult to unravel. And it's actually very disappointing. I was chatting with someone about the other day that,
I knew you'd say that.
That you carry on with this childhood thing that you don't quite debunk when you get older. And so you're always disappointed about Christmas because it's all sort of muddled up with a sort of childhood memory. Right. You know, I remember like lying awake at night as a child, you know, longing for Christmas Day to come. But I don't still do that.
Yeah, you do.
I suppose, no, I just carry on that sort
yeah,
of...
Yeah, right, man, I love it.
Carry on that sort of excitement. Yeah, Mark's crazy about
love
Christmas.
Love a bit of Christmas magic, man. Yeah. Love it.
Have you started listening to Christmas music?
I have, but, to be clear, not really for just pleasure. More, I'm listening to Christian songs and hymns ready for the church services, thinking about whether or not what kind of Christmas songs, rather than the Christmas world stuff. But I'm sure it won't be long.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to weigh up, when can you get your Christmas jumper out?
Never.
It's too early for
is
that.
Is it too early? What about
Christmas
winter jumpers?
Day only, I think.
When are winter jumpers allowed to come out?
Yeah, like, you know, November.
November.
That's safe, yeah.
So winter jumper is allowed?
That's all right. What is a winter jumper? Just a thick jumper?
Thick jumper, but that's often with like snow patterns on it, those kind of things.
Subtle themes.
Subtle theme, but not necessarily Christmas.
Okay, not full fat Christmas.
Yeah, but
never the Christmas hat. Mark has a sort of hat with spiky things coming off of it.
It like only comes out during the snow, though. So, and it never snows.
I think I've seen it. Is it like green and blue?
No, it's blue, and it has then yellow, red, blue. I was trying to convince Barney to wear it for fireworks, but he wasn't up for it. So.
Okay.
So what do you like about Christmas?
Yeah, I'm a big Christmas fan. I have to say I start listening to Christmas music around the October.
Really? You're already in it?
Yeah.
Are you?
I'm super early, but the problem with that is I burn out too soon. So often I get, by the time it's Christmas, I'm pretty sick of the Christmas tunes. But yeah, I feel like I do agree with you, but like Christmas Day is probably like, it's not the highlight of Christmas. I feel like the highlight of Christmas is the build up, you know, the fizzy tension towards the day.
Tension.
That Christmas fizz that you get is, that's the nicest bit, you know? And then Christmas Day comes and it's kind of like, yeah, this is all right, but like, it's the feeling of that month.
It's really difficult to unravel what's basically pagan or selfish and what's kind of like genuine good family stuff that you can thank God for, and then genuinely good God stuff for Jesus's birth.
Yeah.
I think it's difficult to unravel those things myself. I don't think.
And I think the struggle is, I think for all of us, is we do get sucked into the worldly kind of Christmassy kind of films, snow, all of that kind of jazz, and we can lose the actual true meaning of Christmas. And yet, it's the greatest story ever.
I suppose the question is whether there is any true meaning of Christmas. There's just a true meaning of the birth of Jesus, But it's whether there's any...
Is that not the true meaning of Christmas?
Well, there the is, but Jesus. Whether that's
Christmas... I'm now a little bit worried about my fellow co-pastor who tells
Christmas
me there's
is
no true meaning of
Christmas. Christmas is a particular celebration, cultural activity, which has its history, but it's I'm just playing with words, really, to do with, you know, meaning. You know, of course, I believe in the birth of Jesus. It's more to do with whether I believe in that. And talking of historical reality, we had a question on one of our recent apologetics podcasts to do with the eternity or the lack of logic for infinity existing. And
was this a question for the fine tuning or the cosmological?
No, it was a cosmological argument, okay. saying if you argue against infinity, saying infinity is a logical fallacy, how can you then say that kind of God exists forever? So how would we begin to answer that?
Well, oh, Josh, okay. This is your spear.
Well, I'm going to let Graham answer because I know he's asked something really. So I'm not going to.
Well, you can see if you like it or not.
Yeah, you say things, and if I think it's good, I'll say.
I think to be fair, I did a little bit of research as well as thinking about it myself. I think our definition of God is that he is uncaused and he is eternal, but he's not eternal in the sense of a series of causes and effects that go on forever. So he's not infinite in that time sense. He's infinite in that his power and his life existence is immeasurable and is sort of beyond calculation, but he's not infinite in that mathematical sense, which would be absurd, but he's not a series of cause and effect. So I think because he's in a different category altogether, you can say on the one hand, in time space, infinity can't exist, but in God's world, if you like, in the spiritual realm and in the existence that God has in himself, it's not that infinity exists, but he is infinite. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the answer. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense to you guys?
Sounded good to me.
Yeah, don't we also have to come to a point philosophically where there has to be something infinite? There has to be a first cause. So either you're going to have to say that the universe is infinite or that there is something else infinite. You have to have you have to stop at some point, don't you?
You do, yeah. But it's whether you stop. I think our problem is that we're thinking about stops in space-time. Mm-hmm. So we're thinking, well, it has to be a cause that's sitting in space-time, as though God is kind of at the beginning of this point and he's in space-time. But if you take him out of space and time, then... Mm.
What does infinity even mean outside of space and time?
Yes,
yeah,
quite.
Which is what the biblical is that he is the creator of both space and time.
Correct.
Yes.
So it's not that you can't... He can't be in space and time as the creator of space and time. That's just nonsense. Yeah. So that once he's outside of that category, then you're not kind of worried about he is just is in that sense.
It's a good question, though. Deep philosophical question. Yeah. More of those, please.
Yeah, definitely.
Listeners.
So before we get into Christmas itself, I suppose we should just make sure that the story that we're basing our celebration around is actually true.
So there's a bit of a little Christmas apologetics so this will go out hopefully just this being the run up to December. So we're going to think a little bit about Christmas apologetics, what you can say to your friends, but also we're then going to move just to how do you prepare your own heart for Christmas. So you can enjoy Christmas in its fullest sense, in its greatest way.
Yeah, so I have a question to kick us off then. We all know the Christmas story, right? It's kind of part of our cultural Christmas here in Western civilization in terms of nativities, and our kids play it out every year in schools and we talk about it a lot. Do you think, how important is it that we take those events that are recorded as true, and how can we know that they are reliably written about, that those things actually happened, and how important is that?
I think it's really important that it's actually true, because otherwise it's just a mythology, which means A, we can't necessarily believe it, and B, we certainly can't sort of build massive life decisions around it. It's entirely up to sort of our own interpretation. So I think it's important that it's really true, and I think it is. I suppose just on the way to that, because Christmas in our culture is so muddled, with sometimes muddles about the actual story itself, let alone the kind of introduction of Father Christmas. Mm. I mean, there's lots of surveys done every year, which for most non-Christian people, there is a confusion sometimes about, is Father Christmas part of the Christmas story? Did he exist? Did he exist around the time of Jesus and stuff? And so there is genuinely muddles. You know, every year I'll be commenting again on the sort of.
I think we'll get to that question near the end. We'll ask the big question: what about Father Christmas?
Well, indeed, you can ask that one. But what I mean is whether people actually get muddled as to whether he's part of the Jesus story.
I've never come across or had a conversation with someone where they
read my blogs and surveys. Survey says.
Survey says.
Okay, well, I think the further we get away from our Christian heritage as a nation, the more that could become
let's debunk the mystery.
So I think then there's the ones more closer to the story, like there were three kings.
How many kings were there?
I don't know.
They kings?
Indeed. Hmm. So all we know is that there's three kinds of gifts, for example, or that the whole kind of stable thing. So it goes as far in Luke's gospel as saying manger, no room in the guest room, and that's about as far as it goes.
Okay.
So there's a whole kind of narrative built around the stable and everything, which is just a bit more expansive. Mm-hmm. And in other
is
things
that
like
problem?
That, the donkey, not a big deal, but I suppose sometimes people who are not Christians take a pop at it and say, you know, that's not even in the story, or that, you know, and that they kind of use that to build a picture to say, yeah, it's just a sort of mythology. Mm. You know, and it's fine to have donkeys and, you know, various other things going on. It's part of the mythology, and that's fine. And it kind of allows them to sanitize it and to say it's just it's a big myth, and it's all great fun. But it's we've all sort of added to it.
Although I probably have less of a problem with that part of it, in terms of the implication from Luke is, you know, there is no room in the guest. You are in a manger. The likelihood is, where's that, you know, the manger going to be? In terms of that itself, accurate. So is it a wrong step to take on the step? Well, there may have been other animals in there. It was a bit messy. It was low. It was, you know, the rest of the scriptures would pick up on the sense of his humble birth. So I have less of a problem in the sense of the stable scene. It's more of an issue when you start adding in all the extra. For example, the nativity always imposes that, look, that, you know, the wise men turn up. There's three of them, and they turn up when Jesus is in the manger. Well, only the shepherds actually were told did that. Mm. That the wise men actually were probably Jesus was two, but of course that gets conflated. Now you understand why, but of course in one sense you end up then for missing out. You end up kind of misinterpreting or adding fact, which is that what you were just saying then about the manger story, that people then can dismiss it because it's not accurate in that sense.
Yeah, and whether Mary travelled on a donkey to...
Yeah.
You know.
It's a nice little touch, isn't it?
It's a nice little song, little donkey, little donkey,
let's face it,
and all that.
And the kid in the donkey costume always looks cute. But, yeah. You know, all of these things, though, can undermine the Christmas story.
Yeah.
And, you know, let's face it as well, he wasn't born in December. Mm-hmm.
Probably not.
Like March. But I think in one sense, we just need to be much more upfront about this. You know, the reason actually it was the 25th of December is because it was, you know, Constantine 300, you know, it was a festival to a sun god that then got turned into a Christian festival and is maintained as that. And that's, you know, that's okay. But I think sometimes we just need to be aware that we're, A, teaching our children the facts of what the biblical is, and as well as trying to be as much as we can faithful to the story. Because at the end of the day, it's not, you know, you get to Jesus age two, it's a pretty gruesome story, because you've got Herod who's trying to kill him, who ended up killing loads of babies, under two. So it's not a, in one sense, you can sanitize it so much, makes it so nice, and let's face it, we like that, but you miss out on the actual historical reality, which is then picking up and pointing to the greater realities that will be fulfilled in his death and resurrection.
Can I have a little nerdy moment?
Yeah, go for it.
Nerdy moment.
According to a poll last year, which I commented on, 2,000 Britons, that's what they call them, British people, aged between 21 and 38, so these are snowflakes or millennials, Often referred to as snowflake.
Are you a snowflake?
Yeah, he's a millennial.
Snowflake.
Definitely a millennial.
Isn't a snowflake a derogatory term?
That's yes, it is, yeah.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, but okay. When I wrote this article, I thought it was rather cool to say snowflakes at Christmas because it's a little, see what I did there kind of thing?
Oh, clever.
Anyway.
That's why he's director.
So this is between 21 and 38. This is last year, 2,000 people. The half questioned, didn't know the angel Gabriel told Mary she was going to give birth. Fewer than 10%, less than 10% could name gold, frankincense and myrrh as the gifts. Wow. 15% wanted the wise men replaced by wise women. 10% said the donkey should be a unicorn. And 6% thought Santa Claus was somehow involved in the nativity. So, yeah, perhaps it wasn't quite as big a percentage as I remembered, but still a significant number of people.
6% of 2,000. How many people is that then? I can't work it out.
Either 12 or 120.
Yeah.
One of those numbers. This is not a podcast on maths, by the way.
Wow. That is quite astonishing, isn't it? That people.
Yeah.
But that just undermines the point that you're saying, is that actually, in terms of teaching the factual truths of Christmas.
Yeah. So, reeling back to Josh's question, because I took us on a little bit of an aside about making sure we don't add too much to the point that it encourages the idea it's a myth. So coming back to your point, I suppose it comes back to, can we rely on the New Testament documents?
That's right, yeah.
And I would say yes. Do you want to give some reasons for that? Do you want me to give some reasons for that?
Go for it. Off the top of your head.
Well, I suppose off the top of my head, why I rely on the New Testament documents are partly just because of their history. So the four Gospels and some of the letters were written very soon after the events actually happened. So it's their kind of antiquity, their age. So that helps you rely on them because they were written close to the events. Lots of other biographies were written a long time after the people that are spoken about. Most people who understand anything about the generation of mythology would say it takes a good couple of hundred years or more to generate a myth that has a sort of whole life of its own. So you can't generate a myth kind of within a generation of something happening.
And just to give some numbers on that, Mark is the earliest, isn't it?
Mark's probably the earliest. Probably something like 1 Corinthians is actually even earlier in that it talks about the sort of fundamentals of Jesus' birth, death and resurrection.
And we're talking 40 to 65-ish years?
Yeah, we're talking definitely within a generation.
Yeah.
It could be 30 years after the events actually happened.
This is when they were written.
Were written. So there's kind of the age of the documents. There's the fact that there are four Gospels plus a sort of corollary in the letters, because all the letters assume the facts of the Gospel, of the Gospels. So there's the number of letters. And again, people who look at Matthew, Mark, Luke and John say these are written like history books. Anyone who kind of understands the writing of history would say these are very normal accounts of something that historically happened, with a sort of journalistic, slightly different angle from each of them, with sometimes borrowing material from each other. You know, like you find in newspaper articles now all the time, people borrow bits, and so you get sort of cobbled together articles that are bits of something that someone else's. But that's just normally how history gets compiled. So they're like the compilation of history. I think the third thing is the number of documents we have. I mean, you can look it up on the internet yourself, but in terms of statistics, the thousands of copies of either whole Bibles or going back even older, major sort of fragments of Bibles is much more than for any other sort of historical record that we have, much more than people often use, the Julius Caesar's journals or whatever, you know, of which there's a few. But we all believe that Julius Caesar kind of sailed across the English Channel and came to Britain and all those sort of things. So in terms of the quantity of documents, that's another really important thing. And I suppose the last thing is just the coherence of it all, that it all makes sense. So I think that's those are the main reasons why I'd say I believe it. And
you've just got the actual, we have got manuscripts from pretty early on. So up in the Liverpool Museum in Liverpool, is it? The library, I guess it must be. You've got a fragment of a very early copy of John's Gospel, of their manuscript, and kind of pretty much, I think it's dated just around the turn of 100 AD. So you're talking just 60, 70 years after Christ was born. You've got a fragment of a document that actually corresponds really well with what we have got today. So in terms of the integrity of maintaining the manuscripts that were written and what we have today is also really strong as well. So one of the big things for that was the Dead Sea Scrolls in terms of actually maintaining. We found those in the 1940s scrolls that would have been kept for... When were the Dead Sea Scrolls dated at? In the 100, 200? And yet they maintain pretty, correspond pretty well, very closely to what we have. So in other words, we've kept it as well. It's not that they were just written early, but the manuscripts we've got and relate to each other. So in terms of integrity of document, the reliance is pretty high.
In one of our previous podcasts, we spoke to Ben Virgo, and he took us to the British Library. The British Library, there's the Codex Sinaiticus. I was just looking up to make sure I was pronouncing it correctly. Sinaiticus. So basically, it's a whole Bible, Old and New Testament, from about 300 or 400 AD, which is really significant because it's a whole Bible. It's basically corresponds with the text we have now. So to think for 1700, 1800 years, you've got the same thing has been preserved. It's just kind of testament to the fact. It preceded Islam and all sorts of things. So it's very interesting text for lots of reasons.
So I think the basis of saying all this, because we want to give confidence to folks, that as we talk about the Christmas story and you kind of detangle it from the myths, actually it's based on factual evidence. And I think just moving in a gear, you know, Christmas is a great time to be thinking about how to witness to our friends. Because I think even within our culture still, there is still... The resonance that people will happily come along to a Christmas carol service.
Yeah.
You know, and actually using these as an advantage to us, you know, inviting our friends. So beginning now to pray about, okay, who could we bring along and to a carol service or a nativity service or whatever else your church event is putting on? Because in one sense, these are easy wins for us because people will come. But often we're afraid to ask, but actually people love it. They love coming along to the candlelight and singing some of the carols. And maybe it's just what the Lord will use to hear, that they'll hear something that then they'll come along to Christianity Explored in the new year. But, you know, just encourage folks to invite friends, been praying about it and getting out there and doing the business on this one. Because it's an easy win.
I mean, it's a highly accessible story in that the idea of babies and travel and all those sort of things are very easy for people to get their heads around, and shepherds and all those things. So that all kind of works. So it's a highly accessible story. I guess the challenge is it's also an extraordinary story in terms of the virgin birth and the significance that God becomes man. So it's a challenge to kind of draw people in with the story itself, but also to explain meaningfully the theological significance of it. And to get that sort of clear in our heads. Because the virgin birth is not an everyday thing. Babies being born is an everyday thing. And, you know,
and we don't
hostility
need to be ashamed
and
about
Herod and all those sort of things.
Sometimes we feel like we're a bit embarrassed by the virgin birth, but actually we don't need to be.
Or miracles in general.
Yeah, exactly. And there is no need to, you know, and actually I think confronting people with the truth often is what causes them to start to think. Of the realities of that this is not like any other story.
So what about, we're thinking, so good to re-rehearse the actual facts of the Christmas story, good to have an understanding of the reliability of the gospel, good to be thinking and praying about how we can invite people to a Christmas service. What about for ourselves personally and our families during the Christmas festivities? What can we be doing to be different from what the world's doing in terms of the way we're acting, the way we're using money, the way we're being hospitable, how we're thinking about Christmas generally? What should be the distinctives between Christians and non-Christians over this period?
Good question. I think the first thing is you've got to prepare your own heart. And I think one of the things we've really seen come out in the last few years is lots of really helpful Bible readings that take you through Advent that you can do for yourself, and if you have a family or married, to do it with your family, you know, to be reading the story, talking about it each day, thinking about how it connects with some of the Old Testament prophecies and promises. In other words, there is so much good resource out there at the moment. Good Book Company have a number, so do 10 of those. You know, Paul Tripp's just brought out His one of the last years. So there's
great series by Tim Chester. Three different books from him. There's a John Piper one.
John Piper. Who else? Christopher Ash has just launched a new one. So there's so many out there that are really helpful. Mm-hmm. Buy one, take one. And then for the family, there's a brilliant one. Marty Machowski, Prepare Him a Room, is a brilliant. It has a load of events and things that you can do with your kids. In other words, you're not just getting them excited about the presents, but you're getting them excited about the actual true story and kind of going through it with them. Take them, you know, to do those things. So in other words, prepare our own hearts, reminding ourselves of what it really means. Because I think if we when we get that right, then it's the next stage is then it makes us more outward and it makes us think about how we're then going to engage with the world and not just getting sucked into the all the commercial side of it. And then I think this is my little rant, Mark's rant now. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes...
Another jingle.
I think sometimes as Christians, we become a little bit humbugs about Christmas because we don't want to be commercial. Right. And we know that's not right. And so what we do is we kind of play it down. But actually, this is our celebration. Mm. Okay. So we want to be the ones who are celebrating and enjoying. And so we might just need to think about how we do that. So why aren't we not the ones throwing the parties for our streets, for our work colleagues and say, hey, come along. We'd love you to come, you know, and actually having the fun and celebrate the true meaning of Christmas and then thinking about how you then connect that. Mm. So I think, you know, inviting all your neighbours around before the Christmas carol service. Hey, let's have a come around. Come along for some mulled wine, some nibbles. Hey, and then we're going to go on to church together. Because actually, this is our party. So let's celebrate. Let's stop being the bar humbugs. You know, get the trees up, get the lights out. Show that actually we're celebrating, but why we're celebrating. Let people know the reason why we are.
Yeah, that's good.
Every other world religion has big festivals and everyone knows why they're doing it. And we've kind of, we need to take back Christmas. Mm. Bring it on.
Take back control of Christmas.
Take the power back.
Yeah. I suppose I'm really not a humbug. I love Christmas in lots of ways, even though I'm not quite.
But
the but is, I suppose the but is the kind of on the connection of things that are basically materialistic and worldly with the birth of Jesus and the fact that Jesus doesn't ask and there's no evidence that the early church celebrated Christmas as a major festival. So it's not really a festival for Christians, but I'm with you that given that in our culture it has become that, we just as well use it as much as we can. And I think what you're suggesting is an unselfish, if I might say so, an unselfish approach to say, you know, let's be generous, let's be party animals, but in a sort of corporate sense and invite lots of other people in.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really good way to use it, to say here's a cultural marker of something that's very significant to us, and so I'll celebrate it because it's a good thing. There's nothing wrong in what we're doing. And so I'll enter into the whole celebration of it, remembering what the kind of cultural background is, which is the birth of Jesus. There's not a religiousness to it in that we don't have to celebrate Christmas, but I think you just take the opportunities.
That's a good little corrective that
present themselves. And I think that the challenge I know in my own heart is that I can do the Christian religious bit to do with Christmas, and I understand that really clearly, but I've still got to work on my heart to do with not being selfish. So I can go and preach an average or brilliant Christmas Day service, you know, and go back and be lazy in my house and not help with the cooking and, you know, be selfish in the family or something. So I think the same spiritual battles happen on Christmas Day. You know, loads of families have major rows over the Christmas season. So I think as well as being a time that we celebrate, and I agree with everything you're saying about that, Mark, it's also a time where we say we've got to really be careful to make sure we're living as Christians in the light of Jesus' birth and death and resurrection and actually living unselfishly. So we celebrate Christmas unselfishly and we're not ungrateful for our presents, and we teach that to our children and we teach our children to share, and we make sure as adults we're sharing and we take part in, you know, helping and trying to create harmony and not wind up our brother, sister, uncle, whatever it is. So I think there's all those challenges, and I think because we're in proximity to lots of family over Christmas, there's lots of challenges to our sanctification.
Well, and I think, and maybe we'll pick that up in another podcast in just before Christmas, so that we talk about how we are on Christmas Day and how it shouldn't be different, and being generous and being kind and thinking about all those things in the run up to Christmas, and how we have fun.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Ordinary. We're getting close to the end of the year and a little break for the ordinary team, but there are still a few cracking episodes on the way before 2019 is over. So join us again next week for our final guest of the year, Krish Kandaya, who is founder and director of the adoption and fostering charity Home for Good. See you next week.